facing each other. Tsuneko and another hostess immediately hurried over. The other girl sat next to me, and Tsuneko plopped herself down beside Horiki. I was taken aback. Tsuneko was going to be kissed in another few minutes. It wasn't that I regretted losing her. I have never had the faintest craving for possessions. Once in a while, it is true, I have experienced a vague sense of regret at losing something, but never strongly enough to affirm positively or to contest with others my rights of possession. This was so true of me that some years later, I even watched in silence when my own wife was violated. I've tried insofar as possible to avoid getting involved in the sordid complications of human beings. I have been afraid of being sucked down into the bottomless whirlpool. Tsuneko and I were lovers of just one night. She did not belong to me. It was unlikely that I would pretend to so imperious an emotion as regret. And yet, I was shocked. It was because I felt sorry for Tsuneko. Sorry that she should be obliged to accept Horiki's savage kisses while I watched. Once she had been defiled by Horiki, she would no doubt have to leave me. But my ardor was not positive enough for me to stop Tsuneko. I experienced an instant of shock at her unhappiness. I thought, "It's all over now." Then, the next moment, I meekly, helplessly resigned myself. I looked from Horiki to Tsuneko. I grinned. But the situation took an unexpected turn, one very much for the worse. "I've had enough," Horiki said with a scowl. "Not even a lecher like myself can kiss a woman who looks so poverty-stricken." He folded his arms and stared, seemingly in utter disgust, at Tsuneko. He forced a smile. "Some liquor? I haven't got any money." I spoke under my breath to Tsuneko. I felt I wanted to drink till I drowned in it. Tsuneko was in the eyes of the world unworthy even of a drunkard's kiss. A wretched woman who smelled of poverty. Astonishingly, incredibly enough, this realization struck me with the force of a thunderbolt. I drank more that night than ever before in my life. More. More. My eyes swam with drink, and every time Tsuneko and I looked in each other's face, we gave a pathetic little smile. Yes, just as Horiki had said, she really was a tired, poverty-stricken woman, and nothing more. But this thought itself was accompanied by a welling up of a feeling of comradeship for this fellow sufferer from poverty. The clash between rich and poor is a hackneyed enough subject, but I am now convinced that it really is one of the eternal themes of drama. I felt pity for Tsuneko. For the first time in my life, I was conscious of a positive, if feeble, movement of love in my heart. I vomited. I passed out. This was also the first time I had ever drunk so much as to lose consciousness. When I woke, Tsuneko was sitting by my pillow. I had been sleeping in her room on the second floor of the carpenter's house. "I thought you were joking when you told me that love flew out the window when poverty came in the door. Were you serious? You didn't come anymore. What a complicated business it is, love and poverty. Suppose I work for you. Wouldn't that be all right?" "No, it wouldn't." She lay down beside me. Towards dawn, she pronounced for the first time the word death. She too seemed to be weary beyond endurance of the task of being a human being. And when I reflected on my dread of the world and its bothersomeness, on money, the movement, women, my studies, it seemed impossible that I could go on living. I consented easily to her proposal. Nevertheless, I was still unable to persuade myself fully of the reality of this resolution to die. Somehow, there lurked an element of make-believe. The two of us spent that morning wandering around Asakusa. We went into a lunch stand and drank a glass of milk. She said, "You pay this time." I stood up, took out my wallet and opened it. 3 copper coins. It was less shame than horror that assaulted me at that moment. I suddenly saw before my eyes my room in the lodging house, absolutely empty, save for my school uniform and the bedding. A bleak cell devoid of any object which might be pawned. My only other possessions were the kimono and coat I was wearing. These were the hard facts. I perceived with clarity that I could not go on living. As I stood there hesitating, she got up and looked inside my wallet.
"Is that all you have?"
Her voice was innocent, but it cut me to the quick. It was painful as only the voice of the first woman I had ever loved could be painful. "Is that all?" No. Even that suggested more money than I had. 3 copper coins don't count as money at all. This was a humiliation more strange than any I had tasted before. A humiliation I could not live with. I suppose I had still not managed to extricate myself from the part of the rich man's son. It was then, I myself determined, this time as a reality, to kill myself. We threw ourselves into the sea at Kamakura that night. She untied her sash, saying she had borrowed it from a friend at the cafe, and left it folded neatly on a rock. I removed my coat and put it in the same spot. We entered the water together. She died. I was saved. The incident was treated rather prominently in the press, no doubt because I was a college student. My father's name also had some news value. I was confined in a hospital on the coast. A relative came from home to see me and take care of necessary arrangements. Before he left, he informed me that my father and all the rest of my family were so enraged that I might easily be disowned once and for all. Such matters did not concern me. I thought instead of the dead Tsuneko, and longing for her, I wept. Of all the people I had ever known, that miserable Tsuneko really was the only one I loved. A long letter which consisted of a string of 50 stanzas came from a girl at my lodging house. 50 stanzas, each one beginning with the incredible words, "Please live on for me." The nurses used to visit my sick room, laughing gaily all the time, and some would squeeze my hand when they left. They discovered at the hospital that my left lung was affected. This was most fortunate for me, when not long afterwards, I was taken from the hospital to the police station, charged with having been the accomplice to a suicide. I was treated as a sick man by the police, and quartered not with the criminals, but in a special custody room. Late that night, the old policeman standing night duty in the room next to mine softly opened the door. "Hey," he called to me, "you must be cold. Come here, next to the fire." I walked into his room, sat on a chair, and warmed myself by the fire. I feigned an air of utter dejection. "You miss her, don't you?"
"Yes,"
I answered in a particularly faint and faraway voice.
"That's human nature, I guess."
His manner had become increasingly self-important.
"Where was it you first took up with this woman?"
The question was weighted with an authority almost indistinguishable from that of a judge. My jailer, despising me as a mere child who wouldn't know the difference, acted exactly as if he were charged with the investigation. No doubt he was secretly hoping to while away the long autumn evening by extracting from me a confession in the nature of a pornographic story. I guessed his intent at once, and it was all I could do to restrain the impulse to burst out laughing in his face. I knew that I had the right to refuse to answer any queries put to me by the policeman in an informal interrogation of this sort. But in order to lend some interest to the long night ahead, I cloaked myself in a kind of simple sincerity, as if I firmly, unquestioningly, believed that this policeman was responsible for investigating me, and that the degree of severity of my punishment depended solely on his decision. I made up a confession absurd enough to satisfy, more or less, his prurient curiosity.
I've got a pretty good idea now. We always take it into consideration when a prisoner answers everything honestly.
Thank you very much. I hope you will do what you can to help me.
My performance was all but inspired. A great performance which brought me no benefit whatsoever. In the morning, I was called before the police chief. This time, it was the real examination. As soon as I opened the door and entered his office, the police chief said,
"There's a handsome lad for you. It wasn't your fault, I can see. Your mother's to blame for having brought such a handsome boy into the world."
He was still young, a dark-complexioned man with something about him which suggested a university education. His words caught me off guard. It made me as wretched as if I had been born deformed, with a red macula covering half my face. The examination conducted by this athletic-looking police chief was simple and to the point. A world removed from the furtive, tenaciously obscene examination the old policeman had given me the night before. After he finished his questioning, he filled out a form to send to the district attorney's office. He commented as he wrote,
"You mustn't neglect your health that way. You've been coughing blood, haven't you?"
That morning I had had an odd hawking cough, and every time I coughed, I covered my mouth with my handkerchief. The handkerchief was spattered with blood, but it was not blood from my throat. The night before I had been picking at a pimple under my ear, and the blood was from that pimple. Realizing at once that it would be to my advantage not to reveal the truth, I lowered my eyes and sanctimoniously murmured, "Yes." The police chief finished writing the paper.
"It's up to the district attorney whether or not they bring action against you, but it would be a good idea to telephone or telegraph a guarantor to come to the district attorney's office in Yokohama. There must be someone, isn't there, who will guarantee you or offer bail?"
I remembered that a man from my hometown, an antique dealer who was a frequent visitor at my father's house in Tokyo, had served as my guarantor at school. He was a short-set man of 40, a bachelor and a henchman of my father's. His face, particularly around the eyes, looked so much like a flatfish that my father always called him by that name. I had also always thought of him as Flatfish. I borrowed the telephone directory at the police station to look up Flatfish's number. I found it and called him. I asked if he would mind coming to Yokohama. Flatfish's tone when he answered was unrecognizably officious, but he agreed in the end to be my guarantor. I went back to the custody room. The police chief's loud voice reached me as he barked out to the policeman,
"Hey, somebody disinfect the telephone receiver. He's been coughing blood, you know."
In the afternoon, they tied me up with a thin hemp rope. I was allowed to hide the rope under my coat when we went outside, but the young policeman gripped the end of the rope firmly. We went to Yokohama on the streetcar. The experience hadn't upset me in the least. I missed the custody room in the police station and even the old policeman. What, I wonder, makes me that way? When they tied me up as a criminal, I actually felt relieved, a calm, relaxed feeling. Even now, as I write down my recollections of those days, I feel a really expansive, agreeable sensation. But among my otherwise nostalgic memories, there is one harrowing disaster which I shall never be able to forget, and which even now causes me to break out into a cold sweat. I was given a brief examination by the district attorney in his dimly lit office, He was a man of about 40, with an intelligent calm about him which I am tempted to call honest good looks, in contrast to my own alleged good looks, which, even if true, certainly are tainted with lewdness. He seemed so simple and straightforward that I let down my guard completely. I was listlessly recounting my story when suddenly I was seized with another fit of coughing. I took out my handkerchief. The bloodstains caught my eye, and with ignoble opportunism, I thought that this cough might also prove useful. I added a couple of extra exaggerated coughs for good measure, and, my mouth still covered by the handkerchief, I glanced at the district attorney's face. The next instant, he asked with his quiet smile, "Was that real?" Even now, the recollection makes me feel so embarrassed I can't sit still. It was worse, I am sure, even than when in high school I was plummeted into hell by that stupid Takechi tapping me on the back and saying, "You did it on purpose." Those were the two great disasters in a lifetime of acting. Sometimes I have even thought that I should have preferred to be sentenced to 10 years imprisonment rather than meet with such gentle contempt from the district attorney. The charge against me was suspended, but this brought no joy. I felt utterly wretched as I sat on a bench in the corridor outside the district attorney's office, waiting for the arrival of my guarantor, Flatfish. I could see through the tall windows behind my bench the evening sky glowing in the sunset. Seagulls were flying by in a line, which somehow suggested the curve of a woman's body. The Third Notebook, Part 1. One of Takechi's predictions came true. The other went astray. The inglorious prophecy that women would fall for me turned out just as he said, but the happy one, that I should certainly become a great artist, failed to materialize. I never managed to become anything more impressive than an unknown second-rate cartoonist employed by the cheapest magazines. I was expelled from college on account of the incident at Kamakura, and I went to live in a tiny room on the second floor of Flatfish's house. I gathered that minute sums of money were remitted from home every month for my support, never directly to me, but secretly to Flatfish. They apparently were sent by my brothers without my father's knowledge. That was all. Every other connection with home was severed. Flatfish was invariably in a bad humor. Even if I smiled to make myself agreeable, he would never return the smile. The change in him was so extraordinary as to inspire me with thoughts of how contemptible, or rather how comic, human beings are who can metamorphize themselves as simply and effortlessly as they turn over their hands. Flatfish seemed to be keeping an eye on me, as if I were very likely to commit suicide. He must have thought there was some danger I might throw myself into the sea after the woman, and he sternly forbade me to leave the house. Unable to drink or to smoke, I spent my whole days from the moment I got up until I went to bed, trapped in my cubicle of a room, with nothing but old magazines to read. I was leading the life of a half-wit, and I had quite lost even the energy to think of suicide. Flatfish's house was near the Okubo Medical School. The signboard of his shop, which proclaimed in bold letters, "Garden of the Green Dragon, Art and Antiques," was the only impressive thing about the place. The shop itself was a long, narrow affair, the dusty interior of which contained nothing but shelf after shelf of useless junk. Needless to say, Flatfish did not depend for a living on the sale of this rubbish. He apparently made his money by performing such services as transferring possession of the secret property of one client to another, to avoid taxes. Flatfish almost never waited in the shop. Usually, he set out early in the morning in a great hurry, his face set in a scowl, leaving a boy of 17 to look after the shop in his absence. Whenever this boy had nothing better to do, he used to play catch in the street with the children of the neighborhood. He seemed to consider the parasite living on the second floor a simpleton, if not an outright lunatic. He used even to address me lectures in the manner of an older and wiser head. Never having been able to argue with anybody, I submissively listened to his words, a weary though admiring expression on my face. I seemed to recall having heard long ago from the people at home gossip to the effect that this clerk was an illegitimate son of Flatfish, for the two of them never addressed each other as father and son. There must have been some reason for this, and for Flatfish's having remained a bachelor. But I am congenitally unable to take much interest in other people, and I don't know anything beyond what I have stated. However, there was undoubtedly something strangely fish-like about the boy's eyes, leading me to wonder if the gossip might not be true. But if this were the case, this father and son led a remarkably cheerless existence. Sometimes, late at night, they would order noodles from a neighborhood shop, just for the two of them, without inviting me. And they ate in silence, not exchanging so much as a word. The boy almost always prepared the food in Flatfish's house, and three times a day he would carry on a separate tray meals for the parasite on the second floor. Flatfish and the boy ate their meals in the dank little room under the stairs, so hurriedly that I could hear the clatter of plates. One evening, towards the end of March, Flatfish, had he enjoyed some unexpected financial success, or did some other stratagem move him? Even supposing both these hypotheses were correct, I imagine there were a number of other reasons besides of so obscure a nature that my conjectures could never fathom them. Invited me downstairs to a dinner graced by the rare presence of sake. The host himself was impressed by the unwonted delicacy of sliced tuna, and in his admiring delight, he expansively offered a little sake, even to his listless hanger-on. He asked, "What do you plan to do? In the future, I mean." I did not answer, but picked up some dried sardines with my chopsticks from a plate on the table and, while I examined the silvery eyes of the little fish, I felt the faint flush of intoxication rise in me. I suddenly became nostalgic for the days when I used to go from bar to bar drinking, and even for Horiki. I yearned with such desperation for freedom that I became weak and tearful. Ever since coming to this house, I had lacked all incentive even to play the clown. I had merely lain prostrate under the contemptuous glances of Flatfish and the boy. Flatfish himself seemed disinclined to indulge in long heart-to-heart talks, and for my part, no desire stirred within me to run after him with complaints. Flatfish pursued his discourse. "As things stand, it appears that the suspended sentence passed against you will not count as a criminal record or anything of that sort. So, you see, your rehabilitation depends entirely on yourself. If you mend your ways and bring me your problems, seriously, I mean, I will certainly see what I can do to help you." Flatfish's manner of speech. No, not only his, but the manner of speech of everybody in the world, held strange, elusive complexities, intricately presented with overtones of vagueness. I have always been baffled by these precautions, so strict as to be useless, and by the intensely irritating little maneuvers surrounding them. In the end, I have felt past caring. I have laughed them away with my clowning, or surrendered to them abjectly with a silent nod of the head, in the attitude of defeat. In later years, I came to realize that if Flatfish had at the time presented me with a simple statement of the facts, there would have been no untoward consequences. But as a result of his unnecessary precautions, or rather, of the incomprehensible vanity and love of appearances of the people of the world, I was subjected to a most dismal set of experiences. How much better things would have been if only Flatfish had said something like this. I'd like you to enter a school beginning in the April term. Your family has decided to send you a more adequate allowance once you have entered school. Only later did I learn that this, in fact, was the situation. If I had been told that, I should probably have done what Flatfish asked, but thanks to his intolerably prudent, circumlocutious manner of speech, I only felt irritable, and this caused the whole course of my life to be altered.
If you do not feel like confiding your problems to me, I'm afraid there's nothing I can do for you.
What kind of problems? I really had no idea what he was driving at.
Isn't there something weighing on your heart?
For example?
For example, what do you yourself want to do now?
Do you think I ought to get a job?
No, don't ask me. Tell me what you would really like.
But even supposing I said I wanted to go back to school?
Yes, I know. It costs money. But the question is not the money. It's what you feel.
Why, I wonder, couldn't he have mentioned the simple fact that the money would be forthcoming from home? That one fact would probably have settled my feelings, but I was left in a fog.
How about it? Have you anything which might be described as aspirations for the future? I suppose one can't expect people one helps to understand how difficult it is to help another person.
I'm sorry.
I'm really worried about you. I'm responsible for you now, and I don't like you to have such half-hearted feelings. I wish you would show me that you're resolved to make a real effort to turn over a new leaf. If, for example, you were to come to me to discuss seriously your plans for the future, I would certainly do what I could. But of course, you can't expect to lead your former life of luxury on the help that poor old Flatfish can give. Don't give yourself any illusions on that score. No. But if you are resolute in your determination to begin again afresh, and you make definite plans for building your future, I think I might actually be willing to help you to rehabilitate yourself if you came to me for help. Though heaven knows, I haven't much to spare. Do you understand my feelings? What are your plans?
If you won't let me stay here, in your house, I'll work.
Are you serious? Do you realize that nowadays even graduates of Tokyo Imperial University...
No, I wasn't thinking of getting a job with a company.
What then?
I want to be a painter. I said this with conviction.
What?
I can never forget the indescribably crafty shadow that passed over Flatfish's face as he laughed at me, his neck drawn in. It resembled contempt, yet it was different. If the world, like the sea, had depths of 1,000 fathoms, this was the kind of weird shadow which might be found hovering here and there at the bottom. It was a laugh which enabled me to catch a glimpse of the very nadir of adult life. He said,
"There's no point in discussing such a thing. Your feelings are still all up in the air. Think it over. Please devote this evening to thinking it over seriously."
I ran up to the second floor as though driven. But even when I lay in bed, nothing of a particularly constructive nature occurred to me. The next morning at dawn, I ran away from Flatfish's house. I left behind a note, scrawled in pencil in big letters on my writing pad. I shall return tonight without fail. I am going to discuss my plans for the future with a friend who lives at the address below. Please don't worry about me. I'm telling the truth. I wrote Horiki's name and address and stole out of Flatfish's house. I did not run away because I was mortified at having been lectured by Flatfish. I was, exactly as Flatfish described. A man whose feelings were up in the air. And I had absolutely no idea about future plans or anything else. Besides, I felt rather sorry for Flatfish that I should be a burden on him, and I found it quite intolerably painful to think that if by some remote chance I felt like bestirring myself to achieve a worthy purpose, I should have to depend on poor old Flatfish to dole out each month the capital needed for my rehabilitation. When I left Flatfish's house, however, I was certainly not seriously entertaining any idea of consulting the likes of Horiki about my future plans. I left the note hoping thereby to pacify Flatfish for a little while, if only for a split second. I didn't write the note so much out of a detective story stratagem to gain a little more time for my escape, though I must admit that the desire was at least faintly present, as to avoid causing Flatfish a sudden shock which would send him into a state of wild alarm and confusion. I think that might be a somewhat more accurate presentation of my motives. I knew that the facts were certain to be discovered, but I was afraid to state them as they were. One of my tragic flaws is a compulsion to add some sort of embellishment to every situation, a quality which has made people call me at times a liar, but I have almost never embellished in order to bring myself any advantage. It was rather that I had a strangulating fear of that cataclysmic change in the atmosphere the instant the flow of a conversation flagged, and even when I knew that it would later turn to my disadvantage, I frequently felt obliged to add, almost inadvertently, my word of embellishment, out of a desire to please, born of my usual desperate mania for service. This may have been a twisted form of my weakness, an idiocy, but the habit it engendered was taken full advantage of by the so-called honest citizens of the world. That was how I happened to jot down Horiki's name and address as they floated up from the distant recesses of my memory. After leaving Flatfish's house, I walked as far as Shinjuku, where I sold the books I had in my pockets. Then, I stood there uncertainly, utterly at a loss what to do. Though I have always made it my practice to be pleasant to everybody, I have not once actually experienced friendship. I have only the most painful recollections of my various acquaintances, with the exception of such companions in pleasure as Horiki. I frantically played the clown in order to disentangle myself from these painful relationships, only to wear myself out as a result. Even now, it comes as a shock if, by chance, I notice in the street a face resembling someone I know, however slightly, and I am at once seized by a shivering, violent enough to make me dizzy. I know that I am liked by other people, but I seem to be deficient in the faculty to love others. I should add that I have very strong doubts as to whether even human beings really possess this faculty. It was hardly to be expected that someone like myself could ever develop any close friendships. Besides, I lacked even the ability to pay visits. The front door of another person's house terrified me more than the gate of Inferno in the Divine Comedy, and I am not exaggerating when I say that I really felt I could detect within the door the presence of a horrible dragon-like monster writhing there with a dank, raw smell. I had no friends. I had nowhere to go. Horiki. Here was a real case of a true word having been said in jest. I decided to visit Horiki, exactly as I had stated in my farewell note to Flatfish. I had never before gone myself to Horiki's house. Usually, I would invite him to my place by telegram when I wanted to see him. Now, however, I doubted whether I could manage the telegraph fee. I also wondered, with the jaundiced intelligence of a man in disgrace, whether Horiki might not refuse to come even if I telegraphed him. I decided on a visit, the most difficult thing in the world for me. Giving vent to a sigh, I boarded the streetcar. The thought that the only hope left me in the world was Horiki filled me with a foreboding dreadful enough to send chills up and down my spine. Horiki was at home. he lived in a two-storied house at the end of a dirty alley. Horiki occupied only one medium-sized room on the second floor. Downstairs, his parents and a young workman were busily stitching and pounding strips of cloth to make thongs for sandals. Horiki showed me that day a new aspect of his city-dweller personality. This was his knowing nature, an egoism so icy, so crafty, that a country boy like myself could only stare with eyes opened wide in amazement. He was not a simple, endlessly passive type like myself.
You? What a surprise. You've been forgiven by your father, have you? Not yet?
I was unable to confess that I had run away. In my usual way, I evaded the issue, though I was certain that Horiki soon, if not immediately, would grasp what had happened. Things will take care of themselves, in one way or another.
Look here. It's no laughing matter. Let me give you a word of advice. Stop your foolishness here and now. I've got business today anyway. I'm awfully busy these days.
Business? What kind of business?
Hey, what are you doing there? Don't tear the thread off the cushion.
While we were talking, I had unconsciously been fiddling with and twisting around my finger one of the tassel-like threads which protruded from the corners of the cushion on which I sat. Binding threads, I think they are called. Horiki had assumed a jealous possessiveness about everything in his house, down to the last cushion thread, and he glared at me, seemingly quite unembarrassed by this attitude. When I think of it, Horiki's acquaintanceship with me had cost him nothing. Horiki's aged mother brought in a tray with two dishes of jelly.
"What have we here?"
Horiki asked his mother tenderly, in the tones of the truly dutiful son, continuing in language so polite it sounded quite unnatural.
"Oh, I'm sorry. Have you made jelly? That's terrific. You shouldn't have bothered. I was just going out on some business. But it would be wicked not to eat your wonderful jelly after you've gone to all the trouble. Thank you so much."
Then, turning in my direction,
"How about one for you? Mother made it specially." "Ah, this is delicious. Really terrific."
He ate with a gusto, almost a rapture, which did not seem to be altogether play-acting. I also spooned my bowl of jelly. It tasted watery, and when I came to the piece of fruit at the bottom, it was not fruit after all, but a substance I could not identify. I by no means despised their poverty. At the time, I didn't think that the jelly tasted bad, and I was really grateful for the old woman's kindness. It is true that I dread poverty, but I do not believe I ever have despised it. The jelly and the way Horiki rejoiced over it taught me a lesson in the parsimoniousness of the city dweller, and in what it is really like in a Tokyo household where the members divide their lives so sharply between what they do at home and what they do on the outside. I was filled with dismay at these signs that I, a fool rendered incapable by my perpetual flight from human society, from distinguishing between at home and on the outside, was the only one completely left out, that I had been deserted even by Horiki. I should like to record that as I manipulated the peeling lacquer chopsticks to eat my jelly, I felt unbearably lonely.
"I'm sorry, but I've got an appointment today," Horiki said, standing and putting on his jacket. "I'm going now. Sorry."
At that moment, a woman visitor arrived for Horiki. My fortunes thereby took a sudden turn. Horiki at once became quite animated.
"Oh, I'm sorry. I was just on my way to your place when this fellow dropped in without warning." "No, you're not in the way at all. Please come in."
He seemed rattled. I took the cushion from under me and turned it over before handing it to Horiki. But snatching it from my hands, he turned it over once more as he offered it to the woman. There was only that one cushion for guests, besides the cushion Horiki sat on. The woman was a tall, thin person. She declined the cushion and sat demurely in a corner by the door. I listened absent-mindedly to their conversation. The woman, evidently an employee of a magazine publisher, had commissioned an illustration from Horiki and had now come to collect it. "We're in a terrible hurry," she explained.
"It's ready. It's been ready for some time. Here you are."
A messenger arrived with a telegram. As Horiki read it, I could see the good spirits on his face turn ugly.
"Damn it, what have you been up to?"
The telegram was from Flatfish.
"You go back at once. I ought to take you there myself, I suppose, but I haven't got the time now. Imagine, a runaway and looking so smug."
The woman asked, "Where do you live?"
"In Okubo," I answered without thinking. "That's quite near my office."
She was born in Koshu and was 28. She lived in an apartment in Koenji with her 5-year-old girl. She told me that her husband had died 3 years before.
"You look like someone who's had an unhappy childhood. You're so sensitive. More's the pity for you."
I led for the first time the life of a kept man. After Shizuko, that was the name of the lady journalist, went out to work in the morning at the magazine publishers, her daughter, Shigeko, and I obediently looked after the apartment. Shigeko had always been left to play in the superintendent's room while her mother was away, and now she seemed delighted that an interesting uncle had turned up as a new playmate. For about a week, I remained in a state of daze. Just outside the apartment window was a kite caught in the telegraph wires. Blown about and ripped by the dusty spring wind, it nevertheless clung tenaciously to the wires, as if in affirmation of something. Every time I looked at the kite, I had to smile with embarrassment and blush. It haunted me even in dreams.
"I want some money."
"How much?" she asked.
"A lot.
Love flies out the window when poverty comes in the door, they say. And it's true."
"Don't be silly. Such a trite expression."
"Is it? But you don't understand. I may run away if things go on at this rate."
"Which of us is the poor one? And which will run away?"
"What a silly thing to say."
"I want to buy my drinks and cigarettes with my own money. I'm a lot better artist than Horiki. At such times, the self-portraits I painted in high school, the ones Takeichi called ghost pictures, naturally came to mind. My lost masterpieces. These, my only really worthwhile pictures, had disappeared during one of my frequent changes of address. I afterwards painted pictures of every description, but they all fell far, far short of those splendid works as I remembered them. I was plagued by a heavy sense of loss, as if my heart had become empty. The undrunk glass of absinthe. A sense of loss, which was doomed to remain eternally unmitigated, stealthily began to take shape. Whenever I spoke of painting, that undrunk glass of absinthe flickered before my eyes. I was agonized by the frustrating thought. If only I could show them those paintings, they would believe in my artistic talents.
"Do you really? You're adorable when you joke that way with a serious face." But it was no joke. It was true. I wished I could have shown her those pictures. I felt an empty chagrin which suddenly gave way to resignation. I added, "Cartoons, I mean. I'm sure I'm better than Horiki at cartoons, if nothing else." These clownish words of deceit were taken more seriously than the truth.
"Yes, that's so. I've really been struck by those cartoons you're always drawing for Shigeko. I've burst out laughing over them myself. How would you like to draw for our magazine? I can easily ask the editor. Her company published a monthly magazine, not an especially notable one, for children. Most women have only to lay eyes on you to want to be doing something for you so badly they can't stand it. You're always so timid, and yet you're funny. Sometimes you get terribly lonesome and depressed, but that only makes a woman's heart itch all the more for you. Shizuko flattered me with these and other comments, which, with the special repulsive quality of the kept man, I calmly accepted. Whenever I thought of my situation, I sank all the deeper in my depression, and I lost all my energy. It kept preying on my mind that I needed money more than a woman, that anyway, I wanted to escape from Shizuko and make my own living. I made plans of every sort, but my struggles only enmeshed me the more in my dependence on her. This strong-minded woman herself dealt with the complications which developed from my running away and took care of almost everything else for me. As a result, I became more timid than ever before her. At Shizuko's suggestion, a conference took place attended by Flatfish, Horiki, and herself, at which it was concluded that all relations between me and my family were to be broken, and I was to live with Shizuko as man and wife. Thanks also to Shizuko's efforts, my cartoons began to produce a surprising amount of money. I bought liquor and cigarettes, as I had planned, with the proceeds, but my gloom and depression grew only the more intense. I had sunk to the bottom. Sometimes when I was drawing The Adventures of Kinta and Ota, the monthly comic strip for Shizuko's magazine, I would suddenly think of home, and this made me feel so miserable that my pen would stop moving, and I looked down through brimming tears. At such times, the one slight relief came from little Shigeko. By now she was calling me Daddy with no show of hesitation.
Daddy, is it true that God will grant you anything if you pray for it?
I thought that I, for one, would like to make such a prayer. Oh, vouchsafe unto me a will of ice. Acquaint me with the true natures of human beings. Is it not a sin for a man to push aside his fellow? Vouchsafe unto me a mask of anger.
Yes, I'm sure he'll grant Shigeko anything she wants, but I don't suppose Daddy has a chance.
I was frightened even by God. I could not believe in his love, only in his punishment. Faith. That, I felt, was the act of facing the tribunal of justice with one's head bowed to receive the scourge of God. I could believe in hell, but it was impossible for me to believe in the existence of heaven.
Why haven't you a chance?
Because I disobeyed what my father told me.
Did you? But everybody says you're so nice.
That's because I deceived them. I was aware that everybody in the apartment house was friendly to me, but it was extremely difficult for me to explain to Shigeko how much I feared them all, and how I was cursed by the unhappy peculiarity that the more I feared people, the more I was liked, and the more I was liked, the more I feared them. A process which eventually compelled me to run away from everybody. I casually changed the subject.
Shigeko, what would you like from God?
I would like my real daddy back.
I felt dizzy with the shock. An enemy. Was I Shigeko's enemy, or was she mine? Here was another frightening grown-up who would intimidate me. A stranger, an incomprehensible stranger, a stranger full of secrets. Shigeko's face suddenly began to look that way. I had been deluding myself with the belief that Shigeko at least was safe, but she too was like the ox which suddenly lashes out with its tail to kill the horsefly on its flank. I knew that from then on, I would have to be timid, even before that little girl.
Is the lady killer at home?
Horiki had taken to visiting me again at my place.
I could not refuse him, even though this was the man who had made me so miserable the day I ran away. I welcomed him with a feeble smile.
Your comic strips are getting quite a reputation, aren't they? There's no competing with amateurs. They're so foolhardy they don't know when to be afraid. But don't get overconfident. Your composition is still not worth a damn.
He dared to act the part of the master to me. I felt my usual empty tremor of anguish at the thought. I can imagine the expression on his face if I show him my ghost pictures. But I protested instead.
Don't say such things. You'll make me cry.
Horiki looked all the more elated with himself.
If all you've got is just enough talent to get along, sooner or later you'll betray yourself.
Just enough talent to get along. I really had to smile at that. Imagine saying that I had enough to get along. It occurred to me that a man like myself who dreads human beings, shuns and deceives them, might on the surface seem strikingly like another man who reveres the clever, worldly wise rules for success embodied in the proverb, "Let sleeping dogs lie." Is it not true that no two human beings understand anything whatsoever about each other, that those who consider themselves bosom friends may be utterly mistaken about their fellow and, failing to realize this sad truth throughout a lifetime, weep when they read in the newspapers about his death? Horiki, I had to admit, participated in the settlement after my running away, though reluctantly, under pressure from Shizuko, and he was now behaving exactly like the great benefactor to whom I owed my rehabilitation, or like the go-between of a romance. The look on his face as he lectured me was grave. Sometimes he would barge in late at night, dead drunk, to sleep at my place, or stop by to borrow 5 yen. Invariably, 5 yen.
You must stop your fooling around with women. You've gone far enough. Society won't stand for more.
What, I wondered, did he mean by society? The plural of human beings? Where was the substance of this thing called society? I had spent my whole life thinking that society must certainly be something powerful, harsh and severe. But to hear Horiki talk made the words, "Don't you mean yourself?" come to the tip of my tongue. But I held the words back, reluctant to anger him. Society won't stand for it. It's not society. You're the one who won't stand for it, right? If you do such a thing, society will make you suffer for it. It's not society. It's you, isn't it? Before you know it, you'll be ostracized by society. It's not society. You're going to do the ostracizing, aren't you? Words. Words of every kind went flitting through my head. Know thy particular fearsomeness, thy knavery, cunning, and witchcraft. What I said, however, as I wiped the perspiration from my face with a handkerchief was merely, "You've put me in a cold sweat." I smiled. From then on, however, I came to hold, almost as a philosophical conviction, the belief, what is society but an individual? From the moment I suspected that society might be an individual, I was able to act more in accordance with my own inclinations. Shizuko found that I had become rather self-willed and not so timid as before. Horiki remarked that it was funny how stingy I had become, or, as Shigeko had it, I had stopped being so nice to Shigeko. Without a word, without a trace of a smile, I spent one day after the next looking after Shigeko and drawing comic strips, some of them so idiotic I couldn't understand them myself, for the various firms which commissioned them. Orders had gradually started coming in from other publishers, all of an even lower class than Shizuko's company. Third-rate publishers, I suppose they'd be called. I drew with extremely, excessively depressed emotions, deliberately penning each line, only to earn money for drink. When Shizuko came home from work, I would dash out as if in relay with her and head for the outdoor booths near the station to drink cheap, strong liquor. Somewhat buoyed after a bout, I would return to the apartment. I would say, "The more I look at you, the funnier your face seems. Do you know I get inspiration for my cartoons from looking at your face when you're asleep?"
"What about your face when you sleep? You look like an old man, a man of 40.
"It's all your fault. You've drained me dry. Man's life is like a flowing river. What is there to fret over? On the riverbank, a willow tree..."
"Hurry to bed and stop making such a racket. Would you like something to eat?" She was quite calm. She did not take me seriously.
"If there's any liquor left, I'll drink it. Man's life is like a flowing river. Man's river... No, I mean, the river flows the flowing life."
I would go on singing as Shizuko took off my clothes. I fell asleep with my forehead pressed against her breast. This was my daily routine. Et puis on recommence encore le lendemain, avec seulement la même règle que la veille, et qui est d'éviter les grandes joies barbares, de même que les grandes douleurs, comme un corps contourne une pierre sur son chemin.
When I first read in translation these verses by Guy Charcot, I blushed until my face burned. The toad. That is what I was. A toad. It was not a question of whether or not society tolerated me, whether or not it ostracized me. I was an animal lower than a dog, lower than a cat. A toad. I sluggishly moved. That's all. The quantities of liquor I consumed had gradually increased. I went drinking not only in the neighborhood of the Koenji station, but as far as the Ginza. Sometimes I spent the night out. At bars, I acted the part of a ruffian, kissed women indiscriminately, did anything as long as it was not in accord with accepted usage, drank as wildly, no more so as before my attempted suicide, was so hard-pressed for money that I used to pawn Shizuko's clothes. A year had passed since I first came to her apartment and smiled bitterly at the torn kite. One day, along when the cherry trees were going to leaf, I stole some of Shizuko's underrobes and sashes and took them to a pawn shop. I used the money they gave me to go drinking on the Ginza. I spent 2 nights in a row away from home. By the evening of the third day, I began to feel some compunctions about my behavior, and I returned to Shizuko's apartment. I unconsciously hushed my footsteps as I approached the door, and I could hear Shizuko talking with Shigeko.
"Why does he drink?" "It's not because he likes liquor. It's because he's too good, because... Do all good people drink?" "Not necessarily, but... I'm sure Daddy'll be surprised." "Maybe he won't like it." "Look, it's jumped out of the box. Like the funny man in the comics he draws." "Yes, isn't it?"
Shizuko's low laugh sounded genuinely happy.
I opened the door a crack and looked in. I saw a small white rabbit bounding around the room. The two of them were chasing it. They were happy. The two of them. I'd been a fool to come between them. I might destroy them both if I were not careful. A humble happiness. A good mother and child. God, I thought, if you listen to the prayers of people like myself, grant me happiness once, only once in my whole lifetime will be enough. Hear my prayer. I felt like getting down on my knees to pray then and there. I shut the door softly, went to the Ginza, and did not return to the apartment. My next spell as a kept man
was in an apartment over a bar close by the Kyobashi station. Society. I felt as though even